Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on The Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimsey for Reality Check Radio, where we take a look back at last week's event and a little bit of a retrospective, or as has been suggested, we may call it Monday's moot points. And welcome back to the show, William.
Thanks, Dewa. Good to be here again.
I appreciate it. And I've mentioned it already on the show, but I'll be away for roughly a month. So this may be the last roundup for the next little while, unless some kind of alternative host is found for it, but we'll see how that goes. So we'll make the most of this week and we'll get right into the first issue, and I'll make it a domestic issue, not an international issue. And that is going to be around the census data, because you yourself have made quite a bit of commentary on the census data that was released, I believe, last Friday. Just over a week ago, so about 9 days now. And they released a data tool, and we haven't really talked about that yet, but it's taken some time for people to go looking through a lot of the elements of demographic data that census have revealed from the 2023 census, which was a little bit of a botched census. They had a lot of missing data, low response rates, and they tried to massage that data, and then it's taken them over a year and a half, to get the data back to people. And I think, as you have been saying, that there are still a lot of odd things about the census data.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's two issues with the census. The first is there's a lot of funny things that have been botched. I mean, it's been a bit of a train wreck from start to finish, really. And the second thing is that the census reveals the extent and pace of the demographic changes that are going on in New Zealand as a result of the high immigration rates. So it reveals how quickly and how profoundly the Great Replacement is progressing in New Zealand. So just quickly, if you ignore the ethnicity stats, the headline stats that Stats New Zealand has put out, and you dig into the data for yourself, into the Data Explorer, you can see that the New Zealand European population, it's down to 55.9% of the population. The Maori population is 7.3%. The mixed Maori and European population is 8.2%. And then you've got 15.7% Asian, 5.5% Pacific Islander, and 7.4% other. So that's quite low, 55.9% for Europeans. And that suggests that, you know, if the rates of immigration we've been experiencing in recent year or two continue, over 200,000 a year, and also if the rates of New Zealand citizens leaving that are quite high at the moment, if that continues, there's a real chance that by the time the next census comes around, that European New Zealanders could be in an absolute minority, below 50% in New Zealand. Now, lots of things can change. It may not happen. It may take more time than that, but that's something that could happen. Mm-hmm. The other thing to note here with the Maori numbers, like Stats New Zealand are making a big effort about to inflate the Maori category as much as possible. So in the figures that they have produced in their media release, they say New Zealand European are 62.1%, Maori are 17.8%, Indian are 5.8%, Chinese 5.6%, Samoan 4.3%, and then there's some other groups as you go down there. So 17.8% is a very large number of Maori. In the figures I've
produced, add all those numbers up, does that add up to well over 100 as well? Or are they?
Yeah, that adds up to 106.8%.
Yeah. Their maths is not the strong point of Stats New Zealand, is it?
No, they specialize in other things. But yeah, the reason for that is they're double counting the categories. I think that's why they're doing it. So for example, if you're part Maori and part European and you tick both boxes, then rather than just putting you into a mixed Maori European category, they're sort of adding you to both categories. And then when you do that, the total sums to more than 100. But the funny thing is there's more mixed people than so the total it adds to on their data is 106.8%, but there's more than 6.8% mixed. So they're doing something strange where they're not applying exactly the same rules to all groups, unless I've got that wrong somehow. So this,
I think you do have that right, because I ran some of my own calculations that were published on goodoil.news the previous week, and you can find that on rightminds.nz as of Saturday. But I did a calculation where I kind of said, well, what if we prioritize those identifying as New Zealand, as European New Zealand, into kind of a New Zealander ethnicity? And you got that 56% Europeans, you say 8% Anglo-Maori, so European Maori, and 4% other mixed European of some kind to get 68%. But basically, if you look at what they're doing with calculating the Maori electorates, you get 7% Maori and add another 10% when they, so 7% saying that they're exclusively Maori. And that 10%, it comes from basically that 8% that are European Maori, and then another 2% that are Maori, Pacific Islander, Maori, Asian kind of mix. So for the purposes of calculating the numbers of Maori for the electoral calculation, where they determine how many Maori seats there are, they're exclusively counting them that way. So that's where you get those extra numbers from, where they're selectively double counting them depending on what the purposes of the stats they're providing you with.
Yeah, it's not as simple. Yeah, it's not. This, we kind of said this before, just to reiterate. I don't think they're applying a blanket rule of double counting for everyone. They're selectively doing it for certain groups, or at least that is what it appears. They really need to come out and confirm what they're doing there, because that doesn't seem credible from a statistics department to be doing that. That seems just making up your own statistics to prove whatever point you want to prove.
We actually discussed this a number of months ago, you know, before we had the actual raw figures from the census, because it was Elizabeth Rata, I believe, who wrote an explainer sort of on how they calculate Maori electorates and how they kind of came up to their 1 million Maori.
Was that Muriel Newman, you mean?
You might be right, and I could just be misremembering. But and it seems like now that we have the raw numbers, you can sort of guess more so at what they're doing, but still very, very strange from stats, as you say. And they refuse to come out and tell you exactly what it is they're doing to fudge the numbers.
Yeah, yeah. And the ethnicity data isn't the only funny thing that's gone on with the census. If you remember right back to the beginning, there was a big hoopla about the, they included the gender questions. So the census actually had questions about your biological sex and about your gender and about all this other sexuality stuff as well. So I think there are four questions related to that. And that's really buying into quite a radical ideological view of sex and gender that most people don't share. Most people, I think that you can be a man or a woman based on biology, and then there are mentally ill people who are confused about it. And what Stats New Zealand are saying is, no, we're going to legitimize what was previously thought of as a mental illness and create this new thing called a gender identity, which apparently everyone has that didn't know they had. And you've got to tick the box and tell people what it is. So that's a highly ideological view, and it just sort of brings the census into disrepute. A lot of people disagree with that. Then there's the question of, did they get enough responses to make it credible? So for a census to be credible, the idea is you survey basically everyone, or as close to everyone as you can in the country, and to figure out who they all are. They set a target of achieving only 90%, which is still quite low. That's 1 in 10 people not filling it out. And they only got 88.3 or something like that. So they didn't even meet their already quite low target. And this is with people running around to people's houses, offering them, you know, KFC vouchers and Warriors tickets if they'd fill in the forms. So that, that didn't work. They still couldn't make it up to the 90% target, even doing that. And then,
this is one of the reasons they don't release iwi data. So you don't get breakdowns for how large each iwi is, because they say, oh, the response rates were too low for us to provide you with this data.
Not credible. And then there was the issue with Manurewa Marae. If you remember, there's a great big scandal about that, and they've got a sprawling investigation to several government departments going on as a result of what happened there. But with the census data part of it, it looks like what has happened is Stats New Zealand has gone into, you know, done a deal with Manurewa Marae to help them gather the stats information, so go out to people's homes and encourage them to fill in the forms. But the suspicion is that the people at Manurewa Marae have peeked into the data and found out people's addresses and phone numbers and if they're Maori or not, and then use that information for electioneering to go and target them and talk them into voting for the Maori Party or voting for Tash Kemp, who worked at Battery Wimmera.
And she won by 100 and something votes, right? So very small margins.
So that could have made a big difference, that that electioneering. Now, that's still being investigated, but that is I think that is the suspicion about what has happened there. But a number of other dodgy things happened at Manurewa Marae as well. It's not just that. So you can see there's this sort of long-running train wreck that's been going on with the census. And next time they're talking about not even really doing a census next time, they're going to fill in the administrative data, fill in the census information using data they have from other sources, administrative data, they call it. And so that raises, you know, a number of other questions. If we're not actually going to be surveying people, you know, like there's some credibility issues that come in.
Well, if you already have no credibility when you're actually surveying people, how much credibility are you going to have when you stop surveying people and just claim to have the secret data that you've gathered from the other government departments? And then, you know, obviously there's an incentive sometimes, especially when it comes to the ethnicity data, to fudge the figures.
Yeah. And you can see there's a pattern that's happening in other countries. It's happening in Australia, where they're putting all the emphasis on the LGBTQ and the sexuality and the gender identity and putting more questions into the census around that. And they're trying to fudge and take out questions around the ethnicity data and make it harder to actually figure out what's going on. So that's something I think that's probably, they're probably going to try and pull in a number of countries.
The bureaucracy loves talking about how great and wonderful multiculturalism is and how much they love multiculturalism. But then when you want to find out exactly just how multicultural the country is, then suddenly, hang on a minute, you're asking too many questions.
Yeah, no, we don't want to do that sort of thing. So anyway, that's I think that's my summary of most of what's going on with the census there. There's a huge ethnic replacement going on, a huge demographic change, and they've botched the census, and it's very hard to figure out, at least from their headline data, what's going on. Although some of the underlying data in the tables provided still seems as if it's pretty good. So,
and this should concern people, and I've written this in my column for Good Oil and on Right Minds NZ. This should concern people because you've got a lot of institutional bias. Universities, public servants with a lot of anti-white rhetoric, and you're wondering, well, what direction is this country going? And especially if white people were to become a minority in this country, European New Zealanders become a minority, especially when there's institutional bias, what is that going to look like? What is the future going to look like for your children if the country ends up in that shape? And also massive encouragement from these institutions for people to engage in multiculturalism, which is, you know, people seeking their own ethnic interests as a priority, as a political thing. And I go into how we have MPs who say that they represent particular ethnic communities. So we have the example that I use is Paulo Garcia, a National Party MP, quite a conservative guy, but he's talking about how he represents the Filipino community in New Zealand and how great it is the Filipino community is growing, how the Filipino language is increasing in New Zealand more and more. Filipino is being spoken, or Tagalog, I think is the name of the language, sorry, and how their influence is only getting stronger. And he very specifically talks about that as the interest of that particular ethnic community. You've got the same for the Chinese, for the Indians, and so on. It's, you know, not singling him out in particular. And so obviously we have the Maori Party talking about how they represent Maori MPs. You've got Pacific Islanders who talk about how they represent Pacific Island communities. So there's a rapid reorganization of New Zealand politics along ethnic lines. And that's part of the electoral strategies of these parties. They're pretty open about it as well. And so, of course, then the question becomes, okay, well, what about European New Zealanders? What about the old stock New Zealanders, the descendants of the settlers and so on? What about their ethnic interests? Are they allowed to have MPs who talk about their ethnic interests? Well, we already know the answer to that is no, that's not allowed. But there are very serious questions that New Zealanders should be asking about what direction their country is being pushed in. And then a question that we need to answer is, well, what are we going to do about it?
Yeah. And I think it's inevitable that identity politics is an effective political organizing strategy. The groups that do identity politics tend to get their way more than the groups that don't. And so that creates a dynamic where if people want to be effective in their political organizing, they're going to be naturally pushed towards doing identity politics. And that goes for white New Zealanders and white everyone else and all other Western countries too. So
it's no longer a question of, well, is it good or bad? It's the question of, well, it's happening. What are we doing? We're well past that stage where you can be, you know, the discussion of whether it's good or bad. The reality is it's happening and it's only getting stronger.
And when we had more homogenous, more ethnically homogenous states, the government and most of the public institutions were de facto charged with looking after the interests of the homogenous ethnic group in the country. And so as these other ethnic groups have come in under, you know, diversity and multiculturalism, the government has tried to take a sort of neutral stance between the interests of these competing groups. And what that means is that the ethnic majority, who used to be, you know, it used to be their government who looked out for them, and now they don't have a big institution like a government and these other institutions looking out for their interests. And so the natural impulse is to create institutions again that will look after their interests, that will solve those collective action problems that are needed to provide for the interests of that group of people. If you take away the institution that used to do that, naturally there's a vacuum there that will be filled by people trying to create another institution to do the thing that the old institution used to do. And that's really where we're at.
I've got two international issues here that are somewhat tangential to that point that you've just made, one of them being in America and the other being in Australia, one being a free speech issue and the other one being related to, I guess, certain interests being ignored. And we may start with that one in America, where you've had a lot of flooding recently, especially in some of these swing states, Georgia, North Carolina, Florida being hit by a hurricane as well. And there have been some big issues with the federal response, where basically, again, comparing this, the federal government has no issue providing billions of dollars to Ukraine, has no problem providing billions of dollars to Israel, has no problem providing billions of dollars to get hundreds of thousands of Haitians out of Haiti and bring them into America. But then as soon as there's this massive disaster in these rural states, these redneck areas, then suddenly there seems to be a total complete breakdown of the government. You've got the president, the vice president saying, oh, we've offered everything that we can do. It's too hard. We've given all that we can. These are supposed to be their people. That's the response. We've done all that we can. But when it comes to helping other people around the world, suddenly they seem to be able to come up with billions of dollars. When it's their own people in these rural swing state areas, then suddenly these rednecks and these backwaters, then suddenly the flooding, natural disasters, too bad, you're out of luck.
Yeah, well, they're clearly capable of getting the resources together and providing the funds if they have sufficient motivation to do so. They just don't want to do it. And I think this goes to an important point, that society works because people have certain ethical and moral commitments, certain things that they feel obliged, morally obliged to do. And one of those things in the past has always been this sense that a leader's job is to look out for the people that they represent. And it seems as if the leaders in America currently, many of the political leaders at least, no longer feel that political obligation or that moral obligation. And so they're not doing it. They think the money is better spent elsewhere on these, you know, these international aid packages, fighting foreign wars. So that's what we've got. They're also going as far, I mean, there's been rumors about people flying their own rescue missions in helicopters, and they've been told that they're not allowed to do that or they're going to be arrested. There's a whole lot of things going on, not just to not give them money, but to actively make it harder for rescue efforts and things like that to go on in these areas. And that's just abominable, really.
The good news, at least for many of these rural Americans, is they are quite resourceful. Many of their fellow countrymen have, as you've already pointed out, have put help together and are bringing it in as fast as they can, in spite of the federal government trying to slow them down and to stop them. So the situation there will get cleared up, hopefully in time for the election so that all of those people get to vote. And because I think at this point, that kind of response from the federal government is going to influence your vote somewhat quickly. Any developments that you'd like to raise with regards to the US election? I know this is the last time, at least on the weekly roundup, that you'll get to do so, because there won't be any until after the election is over. The next weekly roundup will have a sort of a retrospective on the election. So we've both made our predictions and that we think Trump is going to win. I think so as well. It's clear that especially Elon Musk is putting all his chips down behind Trump as well, and seems to be quite confident, saying this is it, this is the last election. He calls it the last election, the final election, because if Trump loses, then it's over. Kamala will amnesty so many illegals that and make them citizens that no Republican could ever win an election again. So Elon Musk says it's the only important election, the final election.
Yeah, well, the most recent developments are Trump's triumphant, I guess you could say, return to Butler, Pennsylvania, the site of the failed assassination attempt, where he was joined by Elon Musk and also his running mate, J.D. Vance, I think, was there as well. And he resumed his speech from where he left off. And he started off his speech with, "As I was saying," you know, hinting to the fact that he was rudely interrupted last time he was there. So there's something to that. There's something stirring about that, I think. And on the Kamala Harris side, she's recently done an interview with CNN where she doesn't often do well in interviews, and she didn't do well in this interview. So she was asked questions about the why she opened up the southern border, and there was a terrible response. And it looks like, actually, there's some indication that CNN has gone through and, recognizing that her response to that question was so terrible, has edited the response and like pasted in an answer that she gave earlier in the interview into that one to cover up her awful answer. So that's what appears to be happening there.
I listened to parts of that interview, and there were so many wonderful Kamala-isms in that interview. Where you can do it better than I can, but she talks about how the thing, you know, this thing is because that thing. And so the thing, yeah, just a wonderful way of speaking that she has.
What can be unburdened by what has been.
And we will move now very briefly to Australia as well. And this issue is tangential to kind of multiculturalism in that there was a law passed in Victoria, I think maybe last year, basically making the Nazi salute illegal. I say basically, I mean, it added a penalty for making a Nazi salute of $23,000 or 12 months in jail. And there was a guy there who is a Nazi. He says he's an actual Nazi. He believes in Nazism, who went and did a Nazi salute in front of a courthouse. His name is Jacob Hersant. And he's been convicted, and it'll be tomorrow that he'll be sentenced. And the judge has already indicated that he's going to jail. So quite a serious issue, I think, in terms of political expression. You say, like, okay, Nazism is not a nice thing for people to believe, but we're supposed to be a free country, and we're supposed to have democracy and freedom of expression. Somebody who is expressing a political belief shouldn't be going to jail.
That's right. A Nazi salute isn't violence. A Nazi salute is just a form of political expression or philosophical expression or some sort of free expression. And a lot of people don't like it, but there's a lot of things you can do that people don't like. You can give people the fingers. You can do all sorts of things that are offensive and distasteful. And you ought to be able to do those things without going to jail, and you ought to be able to give Nazi salutes without going to jail too.
So I looked at the interview that he did with journalists outside the court. This guy himself, what was his name? Sorry, Jacob Hersant. He looks very well presented, looks like a normal guy. You know, you're thinking like skinhead, tattoos or whatever. No, he looks like a regular guy with some very strange political beliefs. And he did an interview with the media where they said, "Well, you harmed minority groups." And he asks, "How does political expression harm minority groups?" And they said, "Well, the court has ruled that it harms minority groups. And there are people who would feel hurt by what you did." So that's basically the level of reasoning going on in Victoria, Australia. And this seems to be, you know, it's happening in Victoria now, but this is what these people implementing these laws in Victoria, want to do in all of Australia. They want to do this in New Zealand as well. Basically say, you did something, you said something, and there were some minority groups that that felt hurt by what you said or what you did, and now you need to go to prison.
Yeah.
And his response, and I just go for a bit, for his response was as well, was to say, well, I'm offended by, like, say, okay, he said, oh, Jews made it illegal for him to do this, and he's offended by the what the Jews write in the Talmud. He's offended by the Talmud, kind of flipping the argument over. But you could flip this over onto anybody. I think he say, I see here in the transcript, he cites the Liberal Party as well. He says some people are offended by the Liberal Party, you know, but the Liberal Party is obviously allowed to have people offended at it, people hurt by it. You could say the same in New Zealand today. The coalition government, you've got people who say that they're being oppressed by laws that are being passed by the New Zealand government at the moment, that they feel hurt by things that the opinions of the New Zealand government. This is a completely absurd standard that's being applied here in Victoria. And you can see just how these journalists fall in line to say, to like enforce what the regime wants them to silence. There's no journalists who are saying, hang on a minute, we're putting somebody in jail for political expression, like completely peaceful public political expression, even though it may be abhorrent or people may dislike it or feel hurt by it. And the journalists are more than happy to see him thrown in jail.
Yeah, I mean, they're not principled defenders of free speech or what we used to call liberalism even. They're using words, using laws, they're using the legal system to put people who say things they disagree with in jail. That's wrong. And it's not just wrong according to my way of thinking, according to my ideology. That's wrong according to what is ostensibly the ruling liberal ideology. Like our governments and our institutions are being hypocritical. They're not living up to their own professed ethical standards and frameworks in this respect.
And I guess we could just highlight that obviously the laws like this don't actually seem to work, because it seems like instead of people saying, oh, look, there are no more Nazis in Victoria, that someone's willing to say, yeah, I believe in Nazism and go to prison for it in Victoria, which is quite an extraordinary thing in and of itself.
Well, he's got a lot of publicity. It's even kind of sympathetic because all he's done is give a Hitler salute. He hasn't hurt anyone. He hasn't assaulted anyone. He is actually the victim. And so the people who are doing this are kind of, if anything, it's probably going to backfire.
I would agree with you there. And going back to what we were talking about earlier about multiculturalism, it seems to be the driving force here. When you look at the arguments that are made for these kind of laws, is to say, well, because we're multicultural now, we have to make certain things illegal so that you don't offend the other groups. Essentially, we need a stronger state. We need more restrictions on freedom. We need more restrictions on speech, political expression, because we now have so many different minority groups that might be offended, and maybe they'll get violent, and we'll basically need a police state to enforce multiculturalism. And this is, I think, a classic example of, if you have multiculturalism, you're going to need a police state to enforce it.
Yeah, yeah. Those things seem to have gone together. You'll notice that the push for speech restrictions are coming from the same people who are pushing for multiculturalism and diversity and equity and inclusion. That hate speech laws and laws against misinformation and this sort of stuff seem to be part of the same package that goes with the diversity, equity, and inclusion ideology. And that's what that's doing, is it's driving a wedge between what used to be two groups who were kind of allied, the classical liberals, the liberal people, and the more progressive DEI people. Free speech, freedom of association, certain of these freedoms, they are on the liberal side, but they're disagreed with by the DEI side of this alliance. And so it's driving those two apart.
Now, speaking of the DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, I'll just go on to something completely unrelated, actually. The HMS Mana Wainui, New Zealand Navy ship that sunk off the coast of Samoa, I believe. And we still haven't got the results of why it sank, so we're speculating here. But there were a lot of jokes after the ship was sunk that it had to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion. You made a funny, unrelated tweet about spatial intelligence as well. I suppose it's spatial reasoning. I can't quite remember exactly what that was. But maybe you can explain a little bit about what exactly is going on here with people talking about DEI in connection with one of our ships being sunk. Not that that was the reason it sunk, but why it's become a discussion point.
Well, before I repeat my sexist comment, I'd just like to say that I have, I love women, and I have great relationships with women and many, many friends in the female community. So, but look, men and women are different, and even the feminists agree with me about that now, and that's part of their argument against why the trans people shouldn't be allowed in the women's toilets and why the trans people shouldn't be allowed to play in the women's sports department, because there are biological differences between men and women. And all I'm saying is that there are other biological differences between men and women too, and they relate to the way our brains work. And one that's well established in the scientific literature is around spatial intelligence. So women are not less intelligent than men on average. Women are, if anything, very slightly more intelligent than men on average. However, women on some types of intelligence, men and women do differently. And spatial intelligence is one of those. So spatial intelligence is a type of intelligence that allows you to read maps well or visualize environments in three dimensions and like sort of rotate them and navigate through them in your head. It's that sort of intelligence. And men are on average significantly better at that than women are. And that type of intelligence is precisely the type of thing that's very useful for navigation and piloting ships. Now, there's no reason to think that the woman captain in this case was incompetent or had deficient spatial intelligence or any of this stuff. I wasn't talking about her. By all accounts, she's very competent, and by all accounts, she did a good job in declaring the emergency and to evacuate the ship in time, and she may have saved lives. So I have nothing against her at all. But it was just the fact that people were talking about women and differences between men and women on Twitter that spurred me to make the comment.
I saw another funny comment that I think wasn't supposed to be funny, but somebody was making quite a serious case saying that, well, men have been piloting ships and sailing for thousands of years. Men have sunk a lot of ships in that time, made a lot of mistakes and learned. Now that we're finally allowing women to sail ships and command ships and you know, be in the Navy, you've got to give women some time to learn the same mistakes, and so you should be able to expect that more ships will be sunk by women in the coming century, you know, as women adjust to sailing ships. And I think this was a serious argument that was made by a leftist, but it kind of blew up because it was funny, because people thought it was hilarious to suggest that because of diversity, equity, inclusion, you should expect more ships to get sunk, you know, just for the sake of equality.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that. I mean, I have the very simple view that you ought to hire the best person for the job, whether they're a man or a woman. And that if you do that, you're going to, in the case of ships, you're going to have less sunk ships. And in the case of every other profession too, you're going to have less bad things happen if you have the best person for the job.
And just more broadly on this, to wrap up this subject, because we had kind of a strange case where the government sort of welcomed back our returning heroes when all of the sailors were safely brought back from Samoa, kind of put in such a way that this was there was nothing sort of dishonorable or shameful about the fact that this crew and this captain had sunk a ship, which is, I think, about 25% of our fleet, roughly, maybe a little bit less than that, but that's the joke anyway. To think that this is sort of part of this whole diversity, equity, inclusion, part of the whole managerial bureaucracy, is that like, oh, it's nobody's fault. You know, maybe it was just a mechanical failure. Nobody's to blame. There's no shame on anybody. We'll just kind of smooth things over, which maybe you would do in a, you know, it's good for a workplace morale in a non-consequential industry where you want to make sure your team members are all, you know, working effectively. But in a kind of situation where you're talking about combat and people's lives are on the line, that's actually overall a very harmful way to treat people, to say, well, oh well, it's nobody's fault. Everybody's a hero.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the next step would be giving them participation certificates. But It is a sort of sad thing about the modern hero. We used to have a sort of culture of honor, and if you made a mistake, if you were at fault, then the noble thing to do was to own up to it and resign from your job. And this is even taken to further lengths in the case of sea captains who had a tradition of going down with the ship. So if the ship sunk, you sunk with it if you were the captain, and that was the noble thing for you to do. Now, we don't do that anymore, and maybe it's okay that we don't do that anymore, but there is some sort of logic to that way of behaving that we don't have anymore. Everything, you're right, everything is the fault of the system these days, and human agency and human decision-making and concepts of honor don't come into it and aren't allowed to come into it in any way.
I was a young child, I think, when I asked my dad about the planes. I said, "Well, why don't they have parachutes on the planes?" You know, said, "Well, you know, it's difficult to use a parachute." You know, something was wrong to it. But you know, well, I said, "What about the pilots?" So obviously, they could, you know, the pilots could have a parachute, right? They'd be trained to use it. I said, "Well, if we gave the pilots parachutes, then maybe they'd, you know, bail on the plane, right? Like the point is the pilot has to go down with the plane. If the plane's going down, you can't have the pilot survive." And I kind of realized, well, I learned a little lesson there on kind of, you know, the importance, like just how important that job is, as it would be, that if something goes wrong, then you have to die as well. And in that sort of situation. And yeah, if it was in a case of a ship, it's nice if everybody can get off alive, as they did in this case. But at least the overall lack of, you know, the responsibility sitting with someone, that seems to be the initial response. Get rid of that. Oh, we'll do some investigation and maybe we'll whitewash the whole thing. Seems, you know, you think of many different inquiries that we've done, even the COVID one that's going on now. If we talk about the Christchurch terror attack one as well, oh, we'll just whitewash everything. Nobody's responsible. Nobody made a mistake. Actually, we may just segue right into the coroner's inquest, which I think the second phase of that started last week, into that terror attack, saying, which, you know, the police had sort of been absolved of any kind of responsibility in how they issued a firearms license to a terrorist and so on. So perhaps you've got some comments that you'd like to give us on this subject as well, since I think it's a good parallel.
Yeah, well, the Royal Commission of Inquiry already looked at these subjects, and now the coronial inquest is going over the same ground. The Royal Commission of Inquiry concluded that the main problem was that police didn't have sufficient guidance, didn't have sufficient training in assessing the and how to assess people for their firearms license. And crucially, they didn't check whether Brenton Tarrant's referees knew him well enough to really be referees. So the guy came into the country, and within 15 days, he's using a gaming friend that he, I'm not sure, even knew personally apart from over the computer, and the gaming friend's father as his referees. And police didn't do their due diligence and check whether those were appropriate to be referees. That's how he got a firearms license. That's how he was able to buy his guns. And that oversight by police allowed the terrorist attack to happen. So that's the main takeaway. But I think what they're trying to sort of say is, a lot of stuff has come in after the Christchurch terror attack, after the Royal Commission of Inquiry's report. It's sort of been used in a way to bed in woke ideology right across the public sector, including into New Zealand police. And in the last few months, we've had these reports of police turning up unannounced in some cases to people's houses and questioning them about tweets they've put up on social media, or maybe not always Twitter, but other social media posts they've put up, and threatening to take their firearms licenses away over those posts. And I think that behavior and that, you know, it's driven by the same sort of thing that has them doing the police hate speech training or hate crime training. All this stuff came out of the Royal Commission of Inquiry's report. And I think that's not really the main thing. The police didn't do their job right in assessing Brenton Tarrant's, whether he should have a firearms license. But they're putting it back into an ideological thing, using it as an excuse to go after people who have more conservative or more right-wing political beliefs and making life difficult for them.
Yeah, they're using the kind of the giant hole that Jacinda Ardern put into the firearms legislation as well to say, oh, if you have extremist or hateful beliefs or something along those lines, or things that can be seen as being hateful and extremist, that's roughly the interpretation the police have taken. And we've interviewed Gareth, there's nobody on X, I'll just refer to him as Gareth Nobody. It's not his real name, but it's a good enough alias. And he basically got a visit from police because he had posted some things online, some of which was satirical, but none of which promoted violence in any way or could be considered to be hateful or extremist, tending to violence or anything like that, encouraging violence. Some of it was even as simple as saying that he thought all regulations were, not all regulations, but that there were too many regulations, like a libertarian kind of thing, too many regulations. Saying he didn't really trust police that much. I guess police have had, that people have had their trust in the police eroded. And then they came back and used all of that to say, oh, well, we don't think you're fit and proper to have a firearms license anymore now because you said you didn't like the police, basically. So instead of them making any kind of sane application of whether or not somebody may be crazy or unstable or willing to commit violence, or which usually people who know that person would be pretty good at telling you. Instead, they're simply, as you said, going for people's political opinions and saying, oh, you have political opinions that go against the police have been instructed are acceptable political opinions. And this kind of comes around to the issue we were talking about before with Victoria banning certain bits of political expression. Just to put it into other legislation to say, well, okay, it's not a crime. It's not a crime to have these political views, but we're going to make sure you can't have a firearms license. We're going to harass you about it, even though there's nothing that would be linked to violence in any way. In fact, usually people who are engaging in politics are less likely to resort to violence because they have some kind of stake in the political process. It's the entire point of having a democracy and having a political system is that people can engage in power and the transition of power in a peaceful way. And you basically now have the police trying to lock people out of this by saying, well, you can't actually talk about politics. You've got to keep that to yourself, which that is not going to make the situation any better. Like they've, as you say, taken the complete wrong lesson, seemingly deliberately, because they're just using it to put this diversity policy into action. And you've got, and I'm sure of it, you've got these HR ladies, and maybe some effeminate men as well, sitting behind their desks in Wellington, and they're scouring the internet and reports and emails and getting their snitches, you know, to send things in. And then they'll be instructing frontline police to go and harass these people. You know, the frontline police aren't making these decisions. There are people behind the scenes who are giving them these instructions and sitting at these desks in these offices, just looking for an excuse to go and harass someone.
Yep, that's what's happening.
So that was my rant. There was no question there.
well, I mean, I agree with that. I agree with the rant. Yeah.
And we're out of time here today. We may just finish with one bit of good news. TVNZ has announced it's in a little bit of trouble, and it's going to shut down the One News website, and they're making a bunch of other changes. So, final comment for you on what do you think is happening with the media space in New Zealand with free speech? As we've already highlighted, the media is sort of gambled against free speech, aligned itself against free political expression, and they seem to be losing that gamble. If you're shutting down your website, especially in this digital age where the number of people who own TVs are going down, it's a bit of a bizarre decision to keep your TV channel and shut down your news website. But I suspect that the money they get from the government kind of has to be used for maybe TV broadcasting purposes more so. And so they're being forced to focus on that. But it seems like they've just completely shot themselves in the foot now because TV viewership is only going down. So this is basically the end, as far as I'm concerned, of One News and TVNZ if they're deleting their news reporting on their website news reporting.
Yes. Trust in media is going down. It's been going down for a while, but it started to drop more precipitously around the time of the COVID response and around the time of the Labor government funneling large amounts of money into the media in order for them to cover certain things in a way that they liked. So they attached conditions to the way they had to, when they signed up for the Public Interest Journalism Fund, they had to cover Maori issues a certain way. They had to cover, you know, make sure that their coverage was in line with the treaty principles or something like that, which of course you can't be a media organization and have a partisan view on the treaty principles. A lot of people disagree with the treaty principles. And so those people's views are being excluded. They also gave them a whole bunch of COVID advertising money. And so they, you know, the TV was blaring out, go and get vaccinated and two shots for summer or something.
No, please don't give people PTSD by mentioning any of this. That's we're going to trigger terrible flashbacks.
So there's only, and every time you listen to the political reporting, they're always saying stuff that gets on your nerves. There's only so much of that stuff you can watch before it gets on your nerves and you turn them off. And a lot of people are turning them off. Now, a lot of advertising was going away for other reasons as well. People's eyeballs are more on social media and stuff than they are on the traditional news these days. So they're getting less advertising money because they're getting less eyeballs. But yeah, I just think they're in a bad situation. They went all in, sucking up to the government, hoping the government would bail them out indefinitely. But that ruined their trust with the public. And now they're not even much good to the government anymore, because their only value to the government comes from them being trustworthy and people watching them. And if you've blown that, the government's not going to give you any money either.
Absolutely right. And for the listeners, I give you an encouragement to support Reality Check Radio if you're not already. If you're not a foundation member, just go through to the website, sign up. The only way that you can keep alternative media going, let alternative media grow, have these discussions that we're having here, being able to call in to RCR and say whatever you want, being able to write in, mostly uncensored, is something that you need to support. So whatever it is, whether it's RCR or other independent media organizations in New Zealand, I just want to encourage you to give some actual support, financial support, to us or to them, and that is going to make the situation in New Zealand a lot better, and we can turn all of this around and be the real voice of reason and be a good bulwark against the kind of propaganda that these legacy media organizations are putting out, that the government is putting out.
That's right.
And thank you for joining me, William. I'm going to be away on holiday for the next month, but I look forward to returning, and I look forward to doing a big, I guess, US election special retrospective in about a month's time.
Well, happy travels, Tiwa, and I look forward to catching up when you get back.
And to all of the listeners, we will be right back after this break.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.